Hello, everybody. I'm Dwayne Mancini, and welcome to another episode of the Project MedTech Podcast. If you need anything from us or would like to suggest a future guest, you can email us at info@projectmedtech.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. You can always visit our website, www.projectmedtech.com, or follow us on LinkedIn. If you are enjoying this content, don't forget to check out our other podcasts by searching MedTech Money on your favorite podcast platform or by heading to our website. MedTech Money is an interview-style podcast focused on demystifying raising and investing capital for medtech startups. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Galen Data. Galen Data is the cloud for medical device makers. The Galen Cloud provides a configurable platform for device-to-cloud connectivity that is compliant to FDA, HIPAA, and CE mark standards. Built on 40-plus years of collective experience developing compliant systems in the medical device industry, the company's goal is to make medical device cloud connectivity available to all at a fraction of the cost while shaving months off the development timeline. In this episode, our guests Nick Accardino and Will Brotkin from Deloitte and I discuss SPACs, what are SPACs, why would a company want to go public, the differences in going public through an IPO versus SPAC, strategic acquisition versus going public, the myths of going public via a SPAC, preparing your company to go public, and so much more. So without further ado, my discussion with Nick and Will.
Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Talking about the future and what comes next with Project MedTech.
Okay, Will, Nick, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dwayne. Thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Dwayne.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Nick, we'll start with you, and then let's move to Will. But let's just maybe introduce yourselves for the listeners, who you are, and what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks again for having us. So my name is Nick Accardino. I'm a partner located in our Cleveland office of Deloitte. I've been with the firm a little over 16 years. Came up in our traditional external audit practice. But now help lead what we refer to as our accounting advisory and transformation services practice. So a group that largely focuses on the CFO's office and his related organization, you know, accounting, finance, and help across, you know, a broad array of services. I spend a good amount of my time, you know, particularly over the last 2 years, helping companies through public company transactions, you know, whether it be through a traditional IPO or a SPAC transaction. And, you know, while I help a lot with the execution of those deals and kind of getting to the date of transaction and public filing, I do spend a good majority of my time and focus on what we refer to as our sustainment services. So once those companies become public, you know, what do they need to be able to maintain and continue as a public company, meeting all the requirements and so on and so forth. So we'll get into that a little bit more later, but appreciate you again having us and look forward to the conversation. Will?
Sure. Thanks, Nick. And thanks again, Dwayne, for having us. So name's Will Brotkin. I'm actually located in our Houston practice. I lead up our national SPAC execution team, and I'm one of our three regional IPO leaders. So needless to say, it's been certainly been a busy 24 months in our practice, and we're primarily focused on helping with deal execution. So helping prep the company to get through the deal, helping them through their S1 or S4, depending if it's IPO or SPAC, and then onward towards standing up as a public company, similar to the sustainment services that Nick just mentioned. I've been working in the IPO space for the last 10 years, the SPAC space for the last 6 years. It makes me a bit of a SPAC dinosaur from the standpoint of most people have been in SPACs for the last 12 to 18 months. It's certainly been a very interesting market and will continue to be an interesting market as we look forward. So the conversation is very timely today.
Awesome. So let's just start out with the basic of first define what a SPAC is. And I don't know if it makes sense for you to define what a SPAC is and also what an IPO means. So the medtech industry is notorious for a bunch of acronyms, and we're adding even more to this now. But IPO is initial public offering. What does SPAC stand for?
Sure, Dwayne. And so SPAC stands for Special Purpose Acquisition Corporation. And maybe we'll give a definition for that, what that means. So a SPAC goes public via a normal IPO process. So initial public offering, where it raises funds, and those funds are immediately put into an escrow account, a trust account, to be used to acquire a private organization and essentially take them public through that process. So a SPAC in many ways goes through the normal IPO process and then goes through another registration process with the SEC in taking that private company public. So it's a bit different, but the ultimate outcome in many ways is the same, except for capital structure, which I'm sure we'll get into later on in the podcast.
Okay. And so why would So a lot of med tech companies will, you know, you go through series A, B, C, and then maybe you're acquired by one of the strategics, or you're acquired by a large private equity firm. But assuming that you want to continue to commercialize your product, what is the incentive to going public? I guess so. And this could be a very basic question, right? It's just a lot of my world, I'm helping a lot of pre-seed Series A companies. I have exposure to those B and C, but you know, there's only been one company who's been on the podcast that went public via a SPAC. So what's the incentive to, hey, we're going to continue to commercialize this thing. Why would we go public? Why not continue staying private?
Yeah. Valuations are generally the lever of why someone go public. Whenever you sell public your equity to the public markets and securities, the valuation multiples at your company are generally higher. And in order to commercialize your product, getting what I'll refer to as cheaper capital in the door to then put that capital to use to make your organization more mature is often where people land. And some of the reasons that capital is at a higher valuation is because your ability to sell on an open exchange. So for a private company, when you value equity, there's this concept of a discount for lack of marketability. You can't sell your shares easily on a private market. On a public exchange, you can do so. And so that discount doesn't exist at the public markets, and you can go raise more capital and generally receive additional amounts of funding. Your financial statements are public. You can have additional offerings as you go forward. So a lot of people seek the public markets for that reason, if they're continuing to commercialize their company and, you know, lends itself to a more mature channel.
Okay, so is it fair to say, you know, I hear a lot of times, again, specifically med tech companies, and I'm sure other startups in general who have went out and raised venture money, that, you know, those venture capital groups, the private equity groups, the family offices, whoever's, you know, sitting on that board would prefer an exit, right? They'd prefer a acquisition. Why is that the case? And could they also see better return on their investment through, you know, going public, or is it preferred for a reason from a higher multiple, or is it just quicker to have an acquisition?
Yeah. So maybe let's talk about both those outcomes. So in a strategic acquisition, you may be able to sell 100% of the company, and people that are investing in you need a way to get return on their capital back. And in, especially in startups and early stage entities, they are not generating cash flows to return capital back to their initial investors. So the way that they receive their capital back is either by selling the company or taking it public. When they sell the company, oftentimes they receive 100% of their capital back plus returns. If they take a company public, they may receive a higher valuation for their equity that they have, but they likely can't sell 100% of their equity. Certainly we've seen it happen time to time, but those investors can't sell 100%. So now they are selling into the open market over time and living with market risk of holding on to that security. Not only, you know, that specific entity's risk, but also the risk of the market. And so many times people will look at it and determine, are they willing to take the additional value that comes from the security by selling it via an IPO or SPAC path versus maybe a lower value and selling it to a strategic seller, but 100% divesting of their security into that private organization. So, you know, two completely different concepts, but benefits and cons to both when a private equity or venture capitalist is evaluating which path might be best for the company that they're invested in.
Yeah. Okay. Makes sense. And Nick, I don't want you to think I forgot about you here. Do you have anything to add to any of this? I don't know where both of you overlap and where you kind of separate out. So I want to make sure that I'm not just asking back-to-back questions, not giving you a chance to add anything. Is there anything you wanted to add to any of this?
No, I think you're good. And this is, you're in Will's wheelhouse right now. So not a whole lot more to add on that one.
Okay, perfect.
I guess maybe the only thing I will add to that, just as you kind of think through, there's a lot of companies that we work with currently and have worked with over the last, you know, year and a half, 2 years, that don't know which path they want to go when we start the process with them.
Yeah.
Sometimes they explore, you know, they want to look at, hey, how can we get ourselves ready to go either traditional IPO or SPAC, or how do we, you know, get ourselves ready to, you know, do an IPO or dual path it with, you know, potentially a strategic sale, or let's, you know, explore all three. So that's not uncommon for companies that we're working with. And there's different ways that, you know, we help and position and kind of stagger, start and stop different pieces of the preparation process as you go along the way. So certainly not uncommon if you're out there kind of saying, well, how do I understand which path I want to take? You know, a lot of companies are kind of looking at all paths at the same time.
Yeah. Okay, that's helpful.
We see that constantly. Used to be a dual path. Now it's a three-way path to evaluate maybe a SPAC up front and the PIPE markets, maybe file an S-1 with the Securities Exchange Commission, work with the banker to understand pricing, and then at the same time, potentially working with strategics, multiple strategics, to understand what the bidding process looks like in a sell strategy. So you'll see multiple strategies take place, especially at early stage entities.
Okay, so that's helpful. So to make sure I have this right, so if I am the leader of a med tech company, and hey, you know what? I really don't want to exit to a strategic. I want to continue to commercialize this thing and sell this thing. IPO means my investors are probably going to have to hold on to some of their shares, right? When we go public in a SPAC scenario, is that similar to a traditional exit, or is it the same thing there?
It's usually the same as an IPO. Okay. We have seen SPACs do very few, but some have done 100% purchases, what we refer to as a forward merger of the target, but those are very rare. And generally speaking, the SPAC management team is not looking forward to running the GoForward public entity. So they want to bring over the CEO, the CFO. They want to bring over all of the management team so that they can run that company into commercialization, versus a strategic likely has a large amount of the back office support, likely has individuals and roles that can continue to run that company and are looking forward to running that company themselves on a go forward basis. So even in a SPAC, while you may sell more of your equity up front, you're likely to hold on to a certain amount of your equity going forward. And so it's not generally 100% divestiture of the equity, you know, stakeholders.
Okay. So I think I'm starting to understand the differences here. So I appreciate it. So just to be, you know, real clear on the SPACs. So I'll just take an example of one that is publicly on the market. There was an electric car company who went public via a SPAC. So, or there's another company called AppHarvest, right? So AppHarvest goes public via a SPAC. They don't have the name of their stock on the exchange is it's not through AppHarvest though. So there is another group of people or how does this work that lies above there that kind of acquires that company and then takes it public? Is that the process there?
Yeah, so maybe let's talk about the SPAC process more holistically. We really talked about earlier how the SPAC goes public and looks for acquisition targets, but maybe let's talk about how that comes to fruition in its life cycle. So we talked about the SPAC goes public. It raises funds. It puts it into a trust. And they are looking at targets to acquire. So they may enter into an LOI, which is a letter of intent with a target, to work towards a merger agreement. And let's pretend that SPAC has $300 million of capital in its trust. And let's pretend that the target's valued at $1 billion. So day one, and I'll get into redemptions in a minute, but if nobody redeems, 30% of that company is gonna get bought for $300 million. And that target is gonna do an equity for equity exchange. Legally, the SPAC, the public entity, in its simplest form, and I say simplest form because there's lots of different structures, will buy 100% of the target. It will become a subsidiary of the SPAC. And the prior equity owners will exchange shares that they own 70% of the go-forward public company. And anybody that was invested in the SPAC, which has common shareholders as well, will own the other 30%. This gets complicated when we start talking about sponsor shares and the cost of a SPAC and some of the other elements you need to think about if you're thinking about doing a SPAC transaction. But in its simplest form, all those 100% shareholders, if nobody's bought out, just become 70% shareholders of the new PubCo, and can now sell their shares on an exchange.
Okay.
You see avenues where maybe that $300 million is given to the private company, and the company essentially, you know, the shareholders are given $150 million of it, right? So they're bought out from a circumstance of 50% or whatever percentage of that those shareholders are essentially bought out from their initial offering. So we see that quite regularly where that capital comes in, instead of that capital going to the full commercialization of the entity so they can sell their product, a portion of it is given to previous shareholders and those shares are essentially sold as part of the SPAC process. So it happens in different forms. Sometimes the cash stays in, oftentimes, the cash stays in the entity, and many other times, and Nick and I have worked on a couple deals where the shareholders that originally owned the target, in your example, the company that's trying to take its product to market, actually received cash as part of the transaction. So it can happen both ways. But either way, generally speaking, in its simplest form, the SPAC is a go forward public company, and everybody exchanges their shares for shares in the SPAC vehicle, which then renames its ticker, renames its company to something akin to the target that it's buying, and it trades on the open market.
Okay. That's crystal clear at this point. So if you can make a scientist understand this, you can make anyone understand it.
UCF did it with charts and PowerPoints. It's a little bit easier, but I'm trying to do the best I can with just words.
No, this is good. This is good. So is there a scenario where a SPAC would have multiple companies that it's taking public at once, or is it always one company at a time?
No, we have seen it. It's very difficult to do. You're essentially taking, under from SEC standards, and we haven't even gotten into what do you have to do from SEC standards and reporting standards to take your company public via SPAC. But if you go acquire, if a SPAC acquires six entities and say it's going to pick the management team of those six entities to take public, and they're all official targets of the SPAC, all six entities have to go into the registration statement as if they were all going public separately. There are nuances to that, but in its simplest form, that's what has to occur. And that makes for a very difficult transaction. And, saving this for later, but I'll just mention it now. There are myths around SPACs, and the three myths are they're easier, faster, and cheaper. So maybe let's hit the first myth, easier. SPACs require as much and oftentimes more information to be audited and disclosed to the SEC through a registration process than an IPO. So I'll say that again. They require more information. So if you're acquiring six targets, all six of those targets may need to prep their financial statements as if each individually was doing its separate IPO. And then you have to show pro forma results of those six entities in a pro forma table that is extremely, extremely technical, in that it requires max and minimum redemption amounts of the SPAC. We haven't even gotten into how the SPAC vote works, and is all the capital and trust really come into your company, or does it go away if people redeem? So back to my point, the pro formas, the historical financial statements from a technical perspective and a years of requirement protective are oftentimes more onerous than an IPO, and prepping six companies at once to do that can be very difficult to pull off. So while we have seen it occur a handful of times, it is not the predominant way that SPACs acquire targets.
Okay. And so for a company evaluating, hey, we've determined IPO or a SPAC, is it, you mentioned the myths, is it, can you go earlier to a public market via SPAC, or what were the three myths were what? Cost,
easier, faster, easier. And cheaper.
Okay, yeah. So it's not faster than an IPO.
Not faster. Oftentimes longer.
No kidding. The process of actually entering it, or the in terms of like, you could maybe go public before you were as mature as you need to be for an IPO?
Yeah, sure. So I'm talking about the process. So
got it.
So easier. So let's take the easier myth off the table. The financial statement requirements, the ability to file confidentially, which you generally can't do in a SPAC, the pro forma requirements, all more difficult. So let's put that myth away and say, okay, they're not easier. Let's talk about faster for a second. So SPACs, from a practicality perspective of filing with the SEC, starting the merger agreement discussion, signing an LOI, take about 130 days to complete. and they generally have more rounds with the SEC. So from a regulatory perspective, SPACs take longer. And we've already, we'll get to cheaper in a minute because that's all about redemption rates, cost of the SPAC transaction, et cetera. We'll hone in on faster. So why, if they're not easier, not faster, not cheaper, then why do people do SPAC transactions? And there's a multitude of reasons, but one of the primary benefits of a SPAC is it allows you to price up front. So when you enter in your LOI, letter of intent, with a SPAC and negotiate your value, that's kind of your standard value that you're going to work towards a business combination agreement or BCA to finalize your deal and announce publicly. Between your LOI and your announcement is what we refer to as the PIPE process. Think of the PIPE, which stands for private investment and public equity, as the pricing event in an IPO. So people can go public through an IPO, get ready to go public, work on their infrastructure, file their S1, 4 or 5 months later, be at pricing, and the pricing markets, or the market for pricing is gone. The equity markets in total are negative. Maybe your product you're selling, your diagnostic tool has gone negative. Something has happened and you can't price in the market. So all the time and the expense that you spent building in your governance, building in your time to be public, going through the S1 process, hypothetically is sunk dollars because you're not going to go public because the market's not there. A SPAC allows you, this is where it is faster, to essentially price up front. When you go through the LOI and go to the PIPE market, again, private investment, public equity, the capital you're looking to get from the PIPE market is what backstops redemptions in your SPAC. So at the end of the SPAC process, every shareholder gets to vote. Do I vote for the business combination and do I want my money back? So hypothetically, everything the SPAC has in trust can go away. Everybody could redeem and you end up with none of the capital that the SPAC raised in its initial IPO. So the PIPE, which are institutional investors that invest along with the SPAC, is hypercritical to a successful SPAC transaction because they do three things. They backstop redemptions, meaning they bring in cash where is guaranteed into the deal at the end of the deal. They can help bring more cash to the table to close, so higher valuations potentially. And they bring a third party in that says, I want to invest in this deal along with the SPAC. Think of it as a market speedometer, a governor to the vehicle to make sure that valuations don't get too out of whack. So the PIPE process is hypercritical, and that is the point in which you price your security in a SPAC transaction. Again, it happens at the end of the IPO life. So people that evaluate that say, hey, look, I can take beta risk of the market out. I can price up front, talk to the PIPE market, get a deal done, and then start doing all the other things that are necessary to be successful as a public company. There are downsides to that. When you're marketing yourself to the PIPE, you're very much that marketing book, that PowerPoint that you're sharing with them becomes public on the announcement of merger. So you want to be very sophisticated in your approach and how you do that. But nonetheless, that's one of the benefits that people see to a SPAC versus an IPO. I will also say that there has been historically, and I use historically from, call it, February of 2020 to April of 2021, the ability to be a story company, very early stage, and have PIPE capital invested into you. Today, in today's market, that's much more difficult. People want to see some level of commercialization of your product. So yes, earlier has happened often in SPACs. I do think you will still see earlier players in the maturity life cycle seek investment from SPAC vehicles to go public. So I think you're going to continue to see that. I see it every day. But it's not going to be as large as it once was. So anyhow, that was a very long answer to probably a simplistic question. But those three myths, I think, are important to tackle individually.
Yeah, no, this is all important. This is all what feeds into a company deciding, you know, hey, do we stay private? Do we, shoot for some type of exit to a strategic? Do we go public? And whether that be IPO or SPAC, you know, what are the differences there? And so this is all building to the initial question of, you know, why would someone want to even look at this pathway as opposed to staying private? And then once you get into it, there's a bunch more decisions, and we haven't even reached the point of, okay, great, we've decided we want to try to do this, you know, what's next and what right. entails. So I think I'm good on questions from the IPO versus SPAC for now. I'd love to learn about, so when if a startup is gearing up for an exit to a strategic, that due diligence process is long. If they are gearing up for, you know, to be purchased by private equity, that due diligence process is long there, especially, you know, when for med tech, you're talking about, you know, maybe deals in the hundreds of millions of dollars. It's going to take a little bit. What about going public? I mean, what is this due diligence process like? And the other question before I forget, and maybe before we answer this initial, like, hey, we're interested in a SPAC, what are these SPACs looking for in companies? Is it very similar to what a private equity group would look for, what a strategic would look for? Are there specific SPACs that focus in on specific sectors of the market? Is there like an investment thesis there? How does that part work first?
Yeah, so maybe let's tackle these backwards. So when a SPAC goes public and it raises its initial capital, it will generally, inside of its S-1, state what type of company it is looking to target. Many of them are generalist, but some of them may say health tech, biotech, fintech, different elements in the market that they're primarily focused in acquiring a target. Now, SPACs were very popular in the oil and gas patch about 4 or 5 years ago. And, you know, as SPACs continued to evolve, some of those first SPACs that were out in the market as the SPAC journey was occurring and becoming a more popular vehicle, some of those oil and gas SPACs actually bought EV companies. So, right. So, I mean, you have to take a bit with a grain of salt what their target acquisition philosophy is like. But many of the boards will look, if, for instance, if your SPAC is heavily focused in the med tech space, on the boards of the SPAC, you'll likely see bankers that have been in the biotech or med tech or health tech arena. You might see a CEO or a CFO that has large quals in this arena and has access to individuals to find the right target. And a lot of when people develop the boards, they develop the management teams of the SPAC, they have an emphasis on access to those markets. Individuals that know how to do a merger, and individuals that know how to access those markets because they have history in those markets. So you will see in every S-1 some level of disclosure around what they are targeting. And you know, you can go to several websites that are out there that you can go and determine which SPACs may be looking in the field that you're interested in. Most targets today will actually hire a banker to help them do what's referred to as a SPAC bake-off, where you might invite 10 or 15 SPACs into the room, and you get to evaluate them and they get to evaluate you. You know, what's your investment philosophy? How many board seats would you want on the new co-entity? Are you willing to give up some of your sponsor shares, which are the shares that the founders get, and is their quote unquote reward or value that they get from finding a merger candidate? Are you willing to give some of that up and not dilute the company as heavily through your sponsor awards? So there's lots of discussions that are had between sponsor and target in evaluating what I'll refer to as the first level of due diligence, which is, you know, does the investment thesis between our companies make the most sense? And then if we work towards, you know, due diligence in a SPAC transaction, it's certainly evolved over time. The SEC sent out, you know, several releases questioning the amount of due diligence that was being performed in SPACs transactions. And so I have certainly seen from the field and a large uptick in the amount that SPAC sponsors are asking from a level of due diligence, whether that's technology due diligence, quality of earnings, if you're a profitable entity, you know, your patents, et cetera. And the due diligence on many of the deals I have seen have looked similarly to the type of due diligence that you see performed in a strategic acquisition. In an IPO, there is a level of due diligence and care and duty of care placed on the bank. And so the bank itself that's offering your securities to the public market will perform its level of due diligence on you as well. So, you know, there's three different angles at which the due diligence comes from. You'd be very, I think it would be difficult for you today if you're working with a quality SPAC sponsor to get through either three of those levels with little due diligence, given the market and where it's at today.
Hey, well, one of the things, I guess, maybe to pile on that, I think we saw as a change, you know, maybe in the last 6-8 months versus, you know, early 2020 when we, you know, the boom kind of happened, is requirement for having audited financial statements much earlier in the process, sometimes even before LOI is signed, certainly, you know, typically before BCA at times. So what that's done is those audited financial statements can tend to be the long pole in the tent, especially for younger, less mature organizations that maybe have never had an audit done before, or even if they've had an audit done, probably done under, you know, some kind of private company standards, AICPA standards. That is a really large lift. And, you know, if you don't have the proper bench strength in your accounting finance department, you know, that's where, you know, advisors, you know, likely have to come in. But it's that can certainly be an avenue and a part of the process that's overlooked on just how long that could take. We've also seen scenarios where you just can't find firms to come in and do those audits in the time frame, you know, that would be required in order to, you know, start the next phase of your deal. You know, the professional service industry has been extremely strapped over the last, you know, 2 years, all firms ranging from big four down to regional and local firms even that are able to do these audits, you know, just don't have the staff and the resources to do them under those time commitments. So we've seen that in a couple scenarios where, you know, that's really been another kind of holdup and I'd say maybe a change in how, you know, these things are working out as you go along.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really great point. And we saw that evolution, that change really start to occur in December of 2020, when we saw many of the major banks, before they would market you to the pipe investor, the institutional investor, after you signed your LOI with the SPAC, say, we're not doing so until you have your audited financial statements by an individual who would also be auditing you inside of the registration statement or proxy. And I can't tell you how many phone calls I had with, you know, we're going to the pipe in 6 or 7 weeks. We need to find an auditor and get these audited under PCOB standards, as if it was just a flip of the wrist. And the answer is, that's a lot harder to do. Your financial statements have to change to be public company ready, SEC ready. You have to find an auditor that's SEC registered. We saw a tremendous amount of targets had to move away from their current auditor because they were not SEC independent. And so they had to find a new auditor in the course of negotiating a deal. So it created extreme stress, and, you know, the types of services that the Big Four and others provide for audit and advisory services in helping companies get to their public exit or through the merger.
Okay. So real quick, just because this is generally a med tech audience, when Nick and Will are referring to the Big Four, I assume you're talking about the Big Four accounting firms, which are Deloitte, Ernst & Young, PwC, and KPMG, maybe?
That's accurate.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. All right. And it may not just be the Big Four. Banks will accept other audit firms, but, you know, it's probably going to be just a handful others in those that they'll accept as part of a SPAC transaction.
Okay. So Nick, you started bringing up the audit process. And then Will, you kind of tacked on there about the different things you'll need for an audit, how quickly it can happen, that sort of thing. Can we just maybe compare the two of an audit that from a financial standpoint that you might have to go through for a exit to a strategic versus, you know, a SPAC? I mean, from my perspective, it sounds like there's probably pros and cons to both, where maybe from a timing perspective, it's not all that different. Or from a cost perspective, but from the experts, is that accurate, or is there a big cost difference between the two?
A big cost difference. So
okay.
If you're selling to a strategic, especially if you think about maybe they're buying your tech or they're buying your product and your patents, and maybe you're certain, you know, you've gotten a certain path with the FDA or whoever it is you're seeking approval from, they may be buying you on your future capabilities and therefore not be looking to you to upgrade your financial statements, the public company standards, certainly likely will not need a PCAOB audit opinion, which is what I'll refer to as an upgraded audit opinion above an AICPA. You will not need to have SEC disclosures, et cetera. And you may be able to, you likely will be able to use your current auditor, whether that's a regional firm, et cetera. So the cost and the time of your audits when going public and selling public securities versus to a strategic may be light years apart, because you may need to do nothing else from a strategic other than go through your due diligence, which you're going to do with a SPAC anyways. So you've added an extra channel to receive that extra, quote unquote, value from the public equity markets. But as you can imagine, the SEC, other government regulatory bodies have put safeguards in place and additional disclosure requirements if you're going to be selling to the public markets. So there's a tremendous amount of more work. Again, I mean, this probably applies to SPAC and IPO versus strategic, not easier, faster, cheaper. but you know, the valuation different. There are valuation differences that you need to consider.
Right.
And, you know, am I getting 50% more value in my money selling to the public markets versus a strategic? Maybe it's 5%, maybe it's 20%, whatever that delta is, and in the length of time that you may have to hold on to the security in the public markets is going to drive maybe your divestiture behavior and what you decide to do.
Okay. So I will save a, I think you've done a great job so far of kind of painting this picture here of pros and cons and at each step of the way. I'll ask one big question at the end, but I'll hold that for a second. So, audits, I understand now. Okay. So, hey, we've made it this far. I want to do a SPAC. We just talked about, you know, some of those audit requirements. What about, okay, I decide we go through with this. We've listed on the stock exchange, you know, in a med tech case, right, probably the NASDAQ from my understanding. What is the sustain, you know, what do we have to do to sustain being a public company? Because if I'm a, you know, a small company and now we've gone through all this, it's like, okay, I'm thinking in my head, oh boy, you know, it'd probably just be easier if I exited. But if I'm, yeah, if I'm crazy enough at this point to continue going through this, what do I need to be prepared for? Hey, once we're public, what the sustainability of that company, what do I need to do? You know, we're talking about these financial statements from a public company. Some of the other bullet points that I had asked you guys about was IT system, internal controls. Can we just talk a little bit about, you know, actually running a public company now?
Yeah. But I'm going to give kind of one rule of the road and I'm going to turn it over to Nick and then I'll add on, but whether doing SPAC or IPO, just realize that day two as a public company are essentially the same. In fact, you might end up having more regulatory requirements as a SPAC than an IPO, but the way you think about running your company and the governance infrastructure, you shouldn't be, and I hear this a lot in the marketplace, well, I'm just selling myself to a SPAC and I'm not going to worry about day two, but that's a falsehood in the space, okay. Myth number four. So I'll lay the ground with that and turn it over to Nick to talk about sustainment and how we companies should think about governance, infrastructure, controls, et cetera, on a go forward basis.
Yeah, no, this is certainly one we could probably set up another entire podcast to talk about. Life as a public company after an IPO or a SPAC. And, you know, the way you think about it really does kind of differ. And this is, you know, again, kind of going back to speed and timing and how you stage a lot of this. You know, I will say, you know, in our experience and the way we like to handle, you know, this part of the process with a lot of our clients, it is somewhat different leading up to the transaction. When you're doing a traditional IPO, you tend to be able to stand up a lot of the readiness activities, whether it be IT systems, whether it be technology, whether it be, you know, filling out your organizational structure and putting the proper governance in place. You have enough lead time typically in a traditional IPO to get a lot of that underway. No one ever really gets it all the way there. By the time you become effective through a traditional IPO, but you generally have a lot more lead time in preparation to get there. On a SPAC transaction, just due to the speed at which once, you know, an LOI is signed and ultimately a BCA and you go, and just the amount of work between the uplifts of the financial statement audits, like we just talked about, the preparation of all the documents for the SEC, and getting out and kind of going through the churn of filing your S4 and comments. Oftentimes, a lot of these readiness or sustainment services don't come until after some of those are done. So typically after the first S4 is on record with the SEC is when we'll start to dive into some of this stuff. But as Will mentioned, you know, day two as a public company is not different. So, you know, you tend to see a lot more needs for some of these SPAC organizations when it comes, some of the organizations that go public via SPAC, when they do emerge, just because they had a lot less time to prepare. And you know, the trend has been sometimes a little bit less mature than the companies that we've seen go the traditional IPO route. When we think about what this looks like, and we think about kind of the broad buckets that you need to focus on, once you are a public company, we kind of look at it in a couple of different areas. One being you know, corporate governance and thinking about your board composition, governance policies, compensation, stock options of what the new co will ultimately have. We think about financial and SEC reporting. So, you know, not only your annual reporting, but now as a public company, you're now required to do quarterly filings, which most private companies, you know, maybe do some soft closes, but typically have no requirement to issue any kind of financial statements on a quarterly basis, maybe a package to their bank. But oftentimes that doesn't even have disclosure requirements, right? So there's a huge uplift in just the level of reporting that you're going to do, the time to close your books. You know, we come in and a lot of the companies that we work with in the private company space, you know, it could take them 45 to 60 days to close their books and even be ready to start drafting an annual report, set of financial statements. Well, when we get into the public company space, especially if you're a large accelerated filer, you know, you got to get those books closed in 8, 9, 10 days, so that we can move on to getting the financials drafted.
Yeah,
and kind of working through that process.
And Nick, even if you're not a large accelerated filer and you have EGC status, you know, the difference in days in your quarterly reporting is 40 or 45, in which you have to get your 10Q out to the market. So there's not a lot of days added there. And generally the rule of thumb is, as Nick pointed out, 10 days. So if you're looking at your infrastructure and you can't close your books and have a set of financial statements ready, close your books in 10 days, have a set of financial statements ready and probably no later than 15. And I'm talking about day 15, not work day 15. You're behind and you're going to struggle as a public company to be able to get meaningful results out.
Yeah.
So Nick, after all of that, And Will, do you see that when the evolution of a company, a lot of times, you know, the founders of the company, whether they be technical and a business person, will, you know, suffice for a pre-seed or even a seed round. And then, you know, sometimes they creep into Series A, but a lot of companies, you'll see a leadership change at Series A. And then, you know, that person will take them through A, B, C, you know, sometimes D. Do you see going from private to public, a lot of times that there is a leadership change just because of almost everything you just described, of just how different it is to run a publicly traded company versus a private company?
Yeah.
I mean, go ahead, Will.
Well, I was just going to say, in the finance organization, you see tremendous changes in the leadership function. You know, I think it's not uncommon to see someone in the B, you know, after they did the round B of financing, maybe they start dipping their toes in the SPAC, you know, market and evaluating whether that's right for them, maybe after round C. And, you know, some people have prepped for this already and hired CFOs and CAOs, chief accounting officers, for anybody that may be wondering what a CAO is.
Yep. I was.
to take them public. But oftentimes we get in there and they're outsourcing the books and records. You know, they got one person in there from a finance perspective that maybe has a CPA. They don't really have controls. They're on QuickBooks. I'm probably describing a large portion of your audience, and that has to change. I mean, it doesn't mean that the individuals that are there go away. Maybe the current you know, controller stays in the place, but you bring on an accounting, finance, CFO. Maybe you hire a CAO to give that controller further bandwidth. But it's not uncommon that we see CFO and CAO changes and then hiring of additional people underneath them for the additional departments that are created once you go public. At the CFO level, I would say it just depends. I mean, generally, you see the CEO founder have a large continuing role in the go-forward company. Is that chairman? Is that still CEO? Right. I mean, the CEO and CFO are going to be the individuals talking to the public markets quarterly during the earnings release. And so sometimes people look for, probably going to hurt some feelings saying this, more dynamic speakers, potentially, people that can explain the product to a layman in an easier capacity than others, so they can explain their historical financial statement results and the go-forward strategy of the company. So you see that from time to time, but certainly in the finance organization, you see a lot of augmentation and generally some level of higher leadership brought in. Not always, but in many circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say right on that. My reaction was going to be, yeah, oftentimes changes, but I'd say more so build out of the organization. I mean, when we think about any of this sustainment, you know, you really goes back to the three big pillars of people, process, and technology, right? Do you have enough people? Do you have to use some mix of hiring versus outsourcing? And you know, those decisions may change as you progress. You know, what do your processes look like? And then what's your technology platform? And can you really do the things you need to do confidently, accurately, efficiently, to meet all the various deadlines and requirements as a public company? That's really what it comes down to at the end of the day.
Okay. So I just looked, you know, down at the clock and we're 54 minutes into this. I mean, this has been, if you'd have told me that I would have had enough conversation to talk about SPACs for 54 minutes, I'd have been like, no way, right? I mean, coming from a chemistry side of things, but this has been incredibly helpful. So first question is MedTech specifics, IPO and SPACs. Like I said, I'm aware of one just because I know of that company. Is that something you've been seeing recently? I mean, I know, like you said, SPACs kind of exploded in that like 18-month time period or 12-month time period, whatever it was. But have you seen it specific to like med tech and health tech? Have you and try to exclude biotech, so like pharma, yeah, and things like that, specific to med tech, health tech. Have you seen this kind of pick up, or has it been slow, or what's that look like?
Yeah, I in the diagnostics realm of med tech, I've seen a lot of momentum in this space, and I think we're going to continue to see momentum. We need to think about testing, anything from dialysis to COVID, and you know, other treatments. I think we continue to see a demand for those types of products that's increasing investment, and SPACs are also seeking those investments. So I know of several targets that are not public that are evaluating. Some of those may have already signed LOIs. So I think we're gonna continue to see demand there. In the health tech arena, you know, I would say it's more established from a standpoint of I've seen more announcements and been on more deals in the health tech space, specifically tackling the SPAC arena and the IPO arena. Seeing several dual track this process, a couple abandon the SPAC process and go in the normal IPO process. And, you know, we didn't even get into why you may do that from an economic perspective, given the markets where they are today. But when you take a step back and you look at the SPAC market specifically, first off, let's talk about the IPO market. Pricing in a volatile market right now, extremely difficult. And when you have inflation, you have a war going on and other aspects, we have seen fewer and fewer IPOs have the ability to price in this market. And I think that's going to continue until the market stabilizes. Similarly, in the PIPE market for SPACs, the PIPE is key to this. And that's what I mentioned in the beginning. And we're seeing PIPE capital dwane as the capital markets and the SPAC markets continue to see volatility in them. So, you know, SPAC sponsors are doing different things from an economic perspective to make the deal more palatable to PIPE investors to get them involved in the transaction. But time will tell us if that is successful. but there are over 600 SPACs seeking targets today.
Wow.
50% of those terminate in 12 months. So one of the things when I described the SPAC to you in the beginning is that most of these SPACs only have 18 to 24 months. And then once they've reached that time horizon, they either have to extend or give their money back. Most, I am guessing, will not be able to extend because that requires a vote. And the way SPACs are trading, redemption value actually creates value for the investor. And therefore, I think most will end up terminating and giving the money back if they do not find that acquisition target. So you have 300 plus SPACs that in the next 12 months, if they don't find a target, they may be giving their money back. Well, the sponsor, when they set up the SPAC vehicle, funded, you know, call it, depending on the size of the SPAC, let's call it between $6 and $10 million to get the SPAC public. That money is lost if they do not find an acquisition target. So they are going to be busy trying to find good, great companies that they can bring to the PIPE market and get a deal done. So we're going to continue to see the SPAC market evolve. And I think I continue to see tremendous opportunities in the health tech and med tech space, specifically in the med tech space, when we talk about diagnostics and products as it relates to that. I see more and more diagnostic companies. That was a long-winded answer, but I at least wanted to touch on the economics of the deal a little bit and what we're seeing from a marketplace standpoint for your listeners.
Yeah, no, it's really helpful. The larger picture really helps paint that smaller picture within med tech. Diagnostics makes a ton of sense. You know, it's something to be aware of, especially as some of the companies who are maybe looking at this, you know, space can understand it. It certainly helps them as well, I'm guessing, from a negotiation standpoint with some of these SPACs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, 100%. If you are a diagnostic med tech that's reached commercialization and has a level of positive cash flows, which you may be like, wait a minute, those don't exist. They exist. I've seen them. You are going to have an upper hand in a negotiation with the SPAC and the sponsor awards, because you're going to be able to be a great company that could potentially get through the pipe into a merger agreement. If you're a very early stage, haven't reached commercialization, your leverage is going to be very different in the negotiations because of the risk of not being able to get a deal in the pipe. So understanding where you're at in the SPAC market today, and the SPAC market, like the IPO pricing market, evolves over time. So what we tell people is that if you're considering a SPAC or an IPO, be ready, because finding out the window's open and then trying to get ready and then getting through the registration statement, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, by the time you're actually at pricing, the window might have closed. So, have to hit these windows when they're open to be able to have a successful public exit. And that's different for SPAC and IPO, when those windows open and the timing for how you tackle them.
Yeah, I get it. So there's a magazine I get. It's called IBD 50. It's like Investor Business Daily. It's Investor's Business Daily, but it comes weekly. So anyways, I'll notice that IPOs to be filed, there'll be companies that are on there for months. So is this what you're describing when you talk about that window?
That's right. So many of those companies are waiting for their window to open specifically for their space to price.
Got it.
And they have to, if it's an IPO, they have to keep their IPO fresh with the SEC, which means they're constantly filing at least every 90 days. to be able to not have to restart the process with the SEC. So you may, I mean, I've seen companies on there for over a year waiting for their window to open, and that's probably not advisable, right? But what's also not, because it gets costly, but what's also not advisable is, hey, the SPAC market's here. Let's go hire our auditor. Let's go build out our infrastructure. Let's get a deal done. And then you go to try to find an auditor and they tell you 3 months. And then you finally get start your audit process. You're 5 months down the line and the window's closed. Right. Okay. That's probably not a, we've seen it happen a lot. We've seen it be successful because the window was open for so long, right? Our windows were open for 18 months. That is not normal. That is not a normal market. And we're starting to get back into a more normal market where windows are going to ebb and flow, and you have to be ready to be able to execute your plan to seek public capital.
Okay, great. And just to timestamp this for everyone who's listening, we're recording this on Tuesday, March 15th. This will be released later than that, but just in terms of what Will was describing earlier. So Will and Nick, first of all, I just want to let you guys know you both passed the test that I was also administrating while we talk here. So I read an article on August 13th about a company that was going public via a SPAC merger, and I read that article last year and had no idea what most of the things meant in there, other than the fact that they raised Series D capital. I reopened this today and quickly skimmed it. And all of a sudden, all the terminology that I had no idea what meant now made sense, and I could actually follow the article. So I look forward to reading this again after our discussion. Yeah. With that being said, hang on for 1 minute, both of you. We'll chat offline just really quick. But thank you so much for your time today. Will and Nick, I'll have links to both your LinkedIn pages in the show notes. So for listeners who, you know, want to reach out to Nick or Will, you can look up or down an inch depending on the platform and connect with them. I'll have Deloitte's website on there, although it feels like we probably all know who Deloitte is, but there'll still be the website there. In closing, Nick, Will, anything else to add?
Nothing from me, Dwayne, other than thank you for letting us speak with your audience today. We talked about a lot of complicated topics. I will just suggest that if you're seeking these avenues, make sure before you decide which one you're going to seek that you understand the process and the economics. SPACs have, you know, there are a lot of economic differences based on redemption levels, sponsor shares. We lightly hit on all of these items to some extent, but the economics vary drastically from deal to deal. So understand your economics before you seek that endeavor in the process. Similar with an IPO and an acquisition, being educated on the three paths and the process and the economics of those paths is going to help you make an informed decision on what path is right for you.
Dwayne,
I just want to echo Will's comments. Thanks for having us. It was really great spending the afternoon, and you know, obviously talked about a lot of different things, so don't hesitate to reach out if you know you want to double click on something and get some more information. So thanks. Great. Again,
awesome. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you need anything from the podcast, you can always contact us at info@projectmedtech.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.